You know, my wife sometimes accuses me of being obsessed with Nazis. You know, why do you always watch those old documentaries? Why are you reading another book about Hitler? Well, Nazis are fascinating. They had the coolest uniforms. They had these dramatic services where they would burn books and things. They often, you know, march by torchlight. And as Vince from the ShamWow commercial says, those Germans, they just make good stuff. So they even had really good weapons and all the rest of it. In other words, they are the perfect bad guys. And on a less frivolous note, the Nazi regime represents everything that is the antithesis of what we stand for here at this show. We stand for constitutional democracy. They are exactly the opposite. And so from time to time, we're going to talk about the Nazis, and we're going to talk about how their system differs from ours. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and it's all about the Nazis.
Your Weekly Constitutional is produced at WETS-FM in cooperation with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia.
If you're as fascinated by the evil of the Nazi regime as I am, then you may have done a little bit of reading about it, and then you may have realized that one of the groups that was most opposed to Hitler was, paradoxically, the officer corps of the German army. You see, the officer corps of the German army, like many European armies, was drawn from the aristocracy, from those rich guys with all the titles and the castles and things. And they'd been accustomed to running things in Germany for a long time, and they really sort of saw Hitler, well, as an upstart, as a corporal from the First World War who was sort of low class and vulgar, and maybe he was necessary for the resurgence of German nationalism, but they really never liked him. And guess what? He didn't like them either. In fact, that famous plot to kill Hitler in the summer of 1944 was headed up, of course, by Count von Stauffenberg, and maybe you've seen the movie, the Valkyrie movie, and those were basically aristocratic German army officers who were opposed to them. Well, guess what? I met a member of one of those families, and I met him in the least likely of places. I met him in beautiful Grundy, Virginia, where I live and work. His name is Eric von Kleist. And Eric and I go back several years. He was actually one of my students several years ago. And when he was a first-year student, I saw his name on the roster, and I called on him, and I said, are you an aristocrat? And he said, well, I sort of. And so from that point forward, I simply referred to him as Count. And so Count von Kleist and I go back a number of years. And recently, we were just talking, and he said, you know, one of my relatives was actually part of that plot against Hitler. Okay, that was the moment. Did you notice my dramatic pause there? That was the moment I realized I had to talk to Count Eric von Kleist on this show, and he had to tell us his story, and here it is. Well, Eric von Kleist, welcome to your Weekly Constitutional.
Thank you, Professor Harris.
Absolutely. Now tell me, who are you and what do you do?
Well, I'm Eric von Kleist.
Well, very good. We got that part down.
I'm the registrar at the Appalachian School of Law here in Grundy, Virginia.
Oh, so we're going to spend an hour talking about being a registrar at a law school. That sounds like a fascinating interview.
It's an exciting job. It's an exciting job. Involves a lot of spreadsheets.
Well, clearly that's not why I invited you here today. I invited you here today because there's just something, you have an air of aristocracy about you. You seem like an aristocrat to me.
Well, in fact, I am. And
tell us about that.
It doesn't translate well into the United States. It was a very comfortable thing back in the old world, but here in the United States, it's like having vanity tags that never expire.
Well, that's where the von comes from. And for those who are not familiar with it, von is the German word for of. And so it's like saying you are, you know, Richard of Camelot.
Exactly.
But you are Eric of Kleist.
The family Kleist.
The family Kleist, and the von, as the of in English, is typically only given to prominent families. So apparently your family has been prominent in Germany for some time.
In fact, going back to the late 13th century.
The 1200s.
The family association, and we actually have a family association, it celebrated the 700th anniversary of the family in 1989. And going back to that time, it was a time of expansion for the Holy Roman Empire, moving into the northern Slavic states along the Baltic coast, and the family was in the region in Pomerania, which is right on the border between Germany and Poland now, right along the Baltic coast. The family was the first titled family in that region.
That area, that northern, correct me if I'm wrong now, isn't that where the Junkers come from? The great landowning families of the northern part of Germany?
Well, the Junkers actually are Johnny-come-latelys.
Spoken like a true aristocrat.
There are two classes in the German scheme of nobility. The first class is the old nobility, and those are people who whose families were established before the collapse of the Holy Roman Empire. Then there are the new nobility, and those are the peoples whose families were established after the collapse of the Holy Roman Empire.
I see. So you're pre...
Yes, old nobility.
H-R-E.
Right.
Okay,
exactly.
Holy Roman... Yeah. Old money is always more prestigious than new money, right?
Well, again, it didn't translate well to when my branch moved to the United States.
Very nice. Okay, so you've got this old aristocratic family that's at least 700 years old in terms of its German aristocratic identity. And that's really not why we're talking to you, though I do have to note a constitutional nexus here. You know that part of our Constitution actually prohibits titles of nobility in our country.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, I did not inherit a title of nobility. I'm not a baron or a freiherr or a count or anything like that.
Well, actually, I'm glad you mentioned that because, of course, years ago when we first met and I saw your name and we discussed it, I immediately dubbed you Count von Kleist. And that is how I typically address you. But at any rate, Count, that's an interesting constitutional thing. In fact, many people say that the only part of the original seven articles of the Constitution that had anything to do with equality was the titles of nobility provision that prevented the United States government from giving titles of nobility. And, you know, of course, that basically assured equality among the class of people that was already privileged, you know, the people who were already sort of in charge of the country who might have been given such titles. So it really wasn't much in terms of equality, but it's pretty much all we had in our original Constitution. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about something that happened in your family and relatively recent in its history. So why don't you tell us about that?
Well, what brought this to the attention of many people across the world was the recent death of Ewald Heinrich von Kleist, who died at the age of 92 this past summer. And he was, as far as people can tell, the last surviving conspirator in the plot to, several plots, but the well-known plot to assassinate Adolf Hitler during the right at the end of the Second World War.
So the von Kleists are Nazi hunters.
Yes. Definitely not Nazis. In fact, although there were there was a well-known field marshal, Paul Ludwig von Kleist, who served in the war, and other members of the family served in the Wehrmacht, in the German army during the war, none of them were Nazis.
Very interesting. So that is why we're here, because, of course, we often talk about constitutional government, and sometimes it's important to remind ourselves what the alternatives often are. And the alternative to constitutional democratic republics typically are authoritarian states. And the great example of that and of a terrible tyranny is, of course, Nazi Germany. So we've talked about Hitler and we've talked about Nazi Germany several different times on this show. I don't know that we've ever really concentrated on it exclusively. But when I heard about this, when I heard about your relative's passing recently and his connection to the plots against Hitler, I immediately thought we really need to talk about this. He was truly a hero for all freedom-loving people, but especially, of course, for the German people. So why don't we start at the beginning? Why don't you tell us who this guy was and how he got to a position where he was actually plotting against Hitler?
Well, he was the son of a lawyer. His father was Ewald von Kleist von Schminzen. The family has several different branches of the family, and over time they acquire Different variations of the name, but...
And they just add stuff on.
Exactly.
Germans do that. You know, some of their words are about 46 letters long, and I guess they do the same thing with their titles of nobility.
Exactly. Oftentimes, it's to preserve another family where the last surviving member of that family is a female, and the line would die out. And way back when nobility was really regulated and titles were regulated, in that case, the name could be appended to the male's name, so that the name didn't die out.
I see.
So that's one way that happened, and. His father, though, was a German lawyer and was very active even before the war in opposing Hitler, wrote numerous articles opposing the National Socialist Workers' Party, mm-hmm. and in 1938 went as far as being an emissary of two people who were later involved in many of the conspiracies against Hitler, to go to England to speak to the English government against Hitler and warn them about Hitler's plans, imminent plans, to invade the Sudetenland.
That is absolutely remarkable because that, correct me if I'm wrong, that was open opposition to the Nazi Party as late as 1938?
As the missions in 1938 were secret.
Right. Okay, those were secret. When was he writing these articles?
In the late 20s, 29 through 33.
Okay, but he openly came out against the Nazis before they came to power in 33.
Yes, this was his father. This was Ewald von Kleist, yes. Tried to meet with Neville Chamberlain, was unable to meet with Neville Chamberlain, but met with Winston Churchill, who was at that time an opposition minister in the Parliament.
In 1938.
In 38, mm-hmm. and warned Churchill that Germany would invade the Sudetenland. This was in August of 1938, just before the invasion. Mm-hmm. And Churchill later, there was found in the records a letter from Churchill to Ewald von Kleist that said that, you know, his fear was that Germany would invade a smaller country, that France and England would be drawn into the war, and that the war would not end in months, but in 3 to 4 years. And he was pretty close in his prediction.
That is just prescient. And moreover, it seems like then your ancestor was one of the people who was instrumental in making sure that Winston Churchill understood what was going on, apparently well in advance of many of his countrymen.
I think so. Certainly in advance of Neville Chamberlain.
Right. And to return to what I just said, even though his articles were no longer appearing in the late 30s, he had openly declared himself an anti-Nazi back in the day, I mean, when the Nazis were just coming to power. So he must have been a marked man. I mean, I'm just surprised the Nazis let him continue walking around. Why wasn't he in a concentration camp by the late 30s?
Well, he was arrested several times.
Oh, he was?
In fact, even particularly because at one point, people who had estates had received orders to fly the Nazi flag, the Reichsflag, mm-hmm. over the estates, and he refused to do that. And he was arrested at least twice for refusing to do it. Finally, he agreed to do it, and the local political officer was apparently the local school teacher, the Nazi Party political officer. So he erected a flagpole in the middle of a dung heap in a common field in the town and put the flag up. And in order to take it down at night, you would have to walk through the dung heap. And so it stayed up, but it didn't it didn't get tended properly.
But again, as humorous as that is, and as much as it reminds me of Baron von Trapp in The Sound of Music and his refusal to display the Nazi flag, this is a sort of thing that I'm just sort of surprised that the Nazis tolerated. Was it because he was from this powerful aristocratic family that he was sort of getting a pass?
Yes, exactly. The family was close to Otto von Bismarck, married into von Bismarck's family. Prior to the Weimar Republic, and like von Trapp, who was also a Prussian, came from a Prussian background, the Prussian military officers and the families, the large extended families of the Prussian military, traditional Prussian military officers, were very powerful within the army, mm-hmm. and had a lot of, you know, if not influence, at least respect and deference.
Yeah, that actually explains a lot because, of course, we all tend to think of Hitler as having absolute power. And toward the end of his reign, he came pretty close to it. But he, like any other leader, had to consolidate that power, and there were other powerful institutions in Germany, and the army is perhaps the most powerful of all those institutions, and as you say, it was dominated by aristocratic families who were on the general staff and all throughout the officer corps. So that helps me to understand better. He treated your ancestors with kid gloves to a certain extent because he didn't want to do anything that was going to offend the officer corps and the army.
To alienate the rest right. of his power base.
Right.
That's true. In fact, quite a few of the people who were involved in the various plots against Hitler were actually from that old Prussian noble background and military background.
So Hitler was right to be suspicious of them.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And as becomes clear later, he was suspicious of a lot of people and changed his plans very unpredictably, and that saved him on at least one occasion.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and isn't this a cool interview? I just love talking about Nazis. They're the perfect bad guys. And Erich von Kleist, the scion of an aristocratic family, a family that resisted the Nazis, is whom I'm speaking with today. After the break, we'll continue our discussion with Erich von Kleist, but first, a special treat. I know that some of you miss Kelly Carmichael, our old quiz lady. Even if you like the quiz guy, you miss Kelly. Well, we decided to put a classic Kelly quiz in after the break, so stick around. Hey, gang, it's time for the Constitutional Quiz, and Kelly Carmichael, our quiz lady, is here from James Madison's Montpelier. Hello, Kelly.
Hello, Stuart.
Absolutely. Now, get out your pen and paper and get ready to play along. Do we have a contestant?
Yes.
What's your name, contestant?
I'm Adam. I'm from Philippi, West Virginia.
Philippi, West Virginia. Where is Philippi?
It's actually the first land battle of the Civil War up near Morgantown, West Virginia.
Really? I didn't even know that. Well, we'll have to look into the Battle of Philippi at some point.
Interesting.
Very interesting. Okay, Adam, are you ready for the quiz?
Yes.
Kelly, give it to him.
All right, Adam. I hope you like getting into the Sixth Amendment and some of the rights that are in part of that.
Sixth Amendment.
All right, here we go. In addition to guaranteeing a jury trial, the Sixth Amendment also provides that the accused in all criminal prosecutions shall enjoy the rights of A, to be informed of the nature of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to obtain witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense.
No, wait, that's all in A?
That's all in A.
Okay.
Adam, we're going long. You got to have your paper and pen ready.
We're going long. Well, don't worry. We'll go back over. Yeah. What's B?
Yeah. B, to attempt to plea bargain down to a lesser charge, to apply any days spent in jail prior to a conviction towards time served, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense.
That's B.
C, to act as his own counsel for the defense or to seek assistance for the same. And D, to challenge the impartiality of the judge, jury, or prosecutor, to challenge the law under which he is being tried, and to seek assistance in his defense.
Okay, I know we're going to need to hear those one by one. So, Adam, just
would you mind to read the question again also?
Absolutely, okay. Adam, absolutely. In addition to guaranteeing a jury trial, the Sixth Amendment also provides that the accused in all criminal prosecutions shall enjoy the rights of A, to be informed of the nature of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to obtain witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense.
That's A.
That's a mouthful.
What do you think of A, Adam?
I actually think the answer is A.
Okay, you like that one, huh? Okay, that's just, it sounds like a pretty good laundry list of things. I like all those things.
I like all those things.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
So here, let's try B. B, to attempt to plea bargain down to a lesser charge, to apply any days spent in jail prior to a conviction toward time served, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense.
I do not think it is B.
How come?
I don't think plea bargaining is an express constitutional right in the Sixth Amendment.
That sounds very impressive. It's not an express constitutional right. It's not actually in there. Okay. Oh, well, that's
interesting. Morgantown, West Virginia friend.
Yes, indeed. Philippi.
Philippi, that's Philippi. Right. Close, yes.
Come on, that's where the battle was.
Yes, okay. Exactly.
Okay. Go on. So let's see.
C, to act as his own counsel for the defense or to seek assistance for the same.
Well, the right to counsel is a right under the Constitution, but and I think you have a right to act as your own counsel, but I don't think that's expressly enumerated either.
Okay. What about D?
All right. D, to challenge the impartiality of the judge, jury, or prosecutor, to challenge the law under which he is being tried, and to seek assistance in his defense.
I don't think challenging the impartiality of the judge is expressed in the Sixth Amendment of the Constitution.
It sounds like
I'm going to stick with A.
Sticking with A.
I think that sounds like some things that are in the Sixth Amendment, hopefully.
Well, this sounds like a theme here, is that we've got this laundry list, and each one of them is fairly lengthy.
Yeah.
And essentially it boils down to whether Adam knows what's in there, or because a lot of these things sound good.
They all sound great.
They sound really good, so the question is whether they're actually in the Sixth Amendment or not. And you're going to stick with A, are you, Adam?
Yes.
Well, Kelly, what do you say?
Adam, well done.
Well done, Adam. That All was right. really, you nailed it. And that was a very tough question because there were lots of things in there, like plea bargaining, which people do all the time. And, like representing themselves, which they do all the time. Maybe even our constitutional rights, but they're not specifically mentioned in the Sixth Amendment. And so you got the answer correct, and you get your weekly constitutional T-shirt.
I will wear it always.
Excellent.
Wash it occasionally. It looks better.
I will wash it once a week, whether it needs it or not.
Okay. Thank you very much, Adam. We appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And if you're just joining us, we're talking all about an unusual subject today for us. We're talking all about the Nazis and a lot about Hitler and about the Nazi regime, which, as I explained earlier, is the antithesis of a constitutional democracy, of a democratic republic along the Western style. And before the break, we were talking, and we will continue to speak, with Eric von Kleist, who is a descendant of one of the people, one of the aristocratic members of the German officer corps who tried to kill Hitler. Before the break, Eric was telling me that one of the reasons his aristocratic relations were able to operate for so long and to make multiple attempts against Hitler was because Hitler was afraid to offend the German army.
We were in 1938. Mm-hmm. Your ancestor, the father of the one we're going to talk about here, the Ewald Senior, I guess, right. Had just completed his secret mission to Britain, and what happened next?
Nothing. Came back to Germany, picked up life, carried on, maintained communications with people who were in the German resistance as it existed, for his purposes. And then at the same time, or shortly thereafter, in 1940, his son, Ewald Heinrich, who died at 92 recently, Ewald Heinrich became an officer in the Wehrmacht, to join the army, was a lieutenant in the Wehrmacht, and served in the German army, fought primarily in the East when he was fighting. Mm-hmm. And then there were, during that time period, from the beginning of the war, there were plots against Hitler, and those culminated for my family in two specific plots, one of which was to assassinate Hitler when he came to see a demonstration of some military uniforms at an airfield. He was supposed to stop by and approve some new Wehrmacht uniforms.
And when was this?
This was in 1944, January of 1944.
So early 44, before the Allies have landed in Normandy, but after the great reversal at Stalingrad. So most historians will say that the Germans were already in decline as of this point. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that's the point at which all of this latent hostility toward the Nazis really started percolating up, because now it looked as if Hitler was leading the German nation to ruin.
he was.
Okay. Okay. So it's
people,
January.
People began to see that. Yes.
Okay. So and of course, people in the officer corps.
Absolutely.
I mean, if he's back from the Russian front, he's seen. You know, they just lost 600,000 people at Stalingrad, an entire army, and now that, you know, things are not going well. So he comes back from the Russian front, and tell us a little bit more about this plot in then January of 44.
Well, prior to that, and I'll just step back, there had been another plot, which he actually was not involved in which two fake bottles of Courvoisier had been smuggled, had been presented to Hitler, actually, as a present as he got on an airplane at an airport. And had been stowed in the cargo hold of the plane. Mm-hmm. They were bombs, and they had, this was in late 1943, they had fuses in them that were constructed, that operated chemically. The plane flew so high that the bombs froze, and the bombs didn't go off.
Oh, geez, really?
Yes, and when the conspirators understood that, they had to send somebody ahead to the airport. They phoned ahead and had somebody take a duplicate set of real Courvoisier bottles and switch them out at the airport when the plane landed.
wow.
So that had failed. But those same conspirators determined that the next best opportunity to assassinate Hitler would be when he came to view the new Wehrmacht uniforms. He was going to stop at the airport.
In January
44, take a look at the airport.
Which airport? In Berlin? Or?
I don't know exactly which airport.
Okay.
But take a look at the uniforms and then take off and go on his merry way. They contacted Ewald Heinrich von Kleist, who was then still a lieutenant in the Wehrmacht, who had recently come, had been home on leave. And they contacted him and asked him to take part in this operation. And he was supposed to demonstrate the uniforms. And his plan, the plan that was that they came up with, was to take a bomb with him, and he was going to detonate the bomb when the Führer stepped up to look at the uniforms.
He was going to be a suicide bomber.
Yes.
Wow.
He thought, I've read that he thought he could survive the bombing.
Well, he was in his 20s, right?
Yes.
People in their 20s can survive
invincible,
anything, right?
Invincible.
Exactly.
But after he was approached, he returned home, had just come off of leave and returned home and went in to see his father. And his father's response was, you know, why are you here? What are you doing here? You're not on leave anymore. And he said, you know, I've been approached to assassinate the Führer. And his father said, well, you must do this.
Even did his father know that it was probably a suicide?
Yes, yes. It was, you know, it would be a hard decision for anybody to make, I think.
But man, just pause there and think about that for a minute. These guys felt so strongly that Hitler was evil, that they were bad for Germany at least, and that he had to go, that you have a father here telling his son, go and sacrifice yourself to kill this man. That's a remarkable sacrifice for both of them, for both father and son.
It would certainly be a hard thing for me to counsel my son to do.
Absolutely, it really would be.
It would be a very difficult thing.
And a difficult thing to do if you're the son.
Well, yes.
They're two very brave men here.
So unfortunately, the outcome was not good. The plan was set in motion. Ewald Heinrich showed up at the airport, and Adolf Hitler changed his plans. Which he was wont to do, simply because he was afraid of being assassinated. You know, he had food tasters, he had all kinds of security, and one method of protecting himself was to be unpredictable.
Mm-hmm.
So that fell through. The second plot that Ewald Heinrich was involved in was the very well-known plot, which was memorialized in the movie Valkyrie. Mm-hmm. And that was the bombing at the Wolf's Lair in East Prussia, which was Hitler's eastern headquarters.
It's in modern-day Poland, isn't it?
Yes,
I
believe
so,
it is.
Yeah.
Now.
Mm-hmm. So this is a sort of Hitler's forward base that he established when his armies were getting close to their maximum reach into Russia, and he wanted to be closer to the front. And that is where... Well, you tell the story.
Well, Colonel Count von Stauffenberg, who was the essentially the mastermind of this plot, although there were numerous people involved, had managed to he had direct access to Hitler and was going to carry a bomb into the Wolf's Lair, into the headquarters there, into the planning room, conference room, and detonate it, killing Hitler. And at the same time, he had accomplices throughout Germany, primarily in Berlin, who were high in the German military and who were going to take over the military and then the political system.
And it's very important to do because, I mean, killing Hitler, okay, fine, you've killed Hitler, but there's Himmler and there's
Goebbels.
And Goebbels. There's all sorts of nasty people ready to step up. Mm-hmm. And continue the Nazi terror and continue the policies that these people didn't like. So, yeah, that was a very important part of it. Now, what, just in case people haven't seen the movie or haven't heard about this, what happened with that one?
Well, the bomb went off. The bomb was placed. Von Stauffenberg excused himself and left the building, was still nearby, saw the bomb go off, saw the damage and destruction and dead bodies, and made the mistaken assumption that Adolf Hitler had been killed. So he set in motion, via telephone, the plans to seize control of the government.
But what saved Hitler?
Pure luck. One of the orderlies in the conference room, one of the participants in the conference room, had moved the briefcase with the bomb from directly beside Hitler to the outside of the table, outside of a very, very heavy, thick wooden oak leg of the table, which spanned the entire width of a table. And when the bomb went off, the damage was confined to that one end of the table. Hitler was bruised and battered and burned a little bit, and I think he had a punctured eardrum, but he was not killed, not even severely injured.
Right.
Von Stauffenberg, however, called Berlin and gave the orders to go ahead and take over the government. Ewald Heinrich von Kleist was in Berlin, again, still a lieutenant, but he was in the supporting operation of the generals who were in Berlin that were executing the plan to take over the government. They started issuing orders. They called various people. They called the commander of the German forces in the east and told him to start retreating immediately. They called the commander of the German forces in France and told him to start a withdrawal immediately. But unfortunately, word got back to Berlin, and eventually Hitler came back on the radio that same day, and people found out that he was not dead, and the whole thing collapsed. Fortunately for Ewald Heinrich von Kleist, although not fortunately for conspirators, many of the officers in charge who knew about the conspiracy were summarily executed in Berlin after they were arrested. They were just lined up against a wall and shot. Because of that, they didn't get a chance to talk.
Oh, okay. See, that my next question was going to be, you know, your relative, Ewald Heinrich, was in a subordinate role, but he was still very much part of this.
Exactly.
And I was going to say, how did they not find out about him? It's because their vengeance was too swift. They didn't keep these guys and get them to reveal who else was in the conspiracy.
Right. The people who arrested them immediately just summarily executed them, and that sealed their mouths. Later on, however, as the plot had failed and investigations began and people began to be rounded up, both Ewald Heinrich and his father were arrested. Heinrich von Kleist was tried, in fact, by the German judge Friesling, who mm-hmm. is the famous Nazi kangaroo court judge.
Infamous,
infamous, exactly, who wore the florid robes and screamed at people from the bench and foamed at the mouth as he conducted his trials, essentially. And he was on trial in April of 1945 by this judge.
So wait a second, he was arrested?
He was arrested.
Because apparently somebody cast suspicion on him. Or was his name simply on the list of
somebody
to be? Yeah.
Association by name.
Okay, so they didn't necessarily have any evidence of his being involved in this, but he was just a guy from a family that had long been a thorn in Hitler's side.
Exactly. Both of them were.
Both of them were, and so they're the usual suspects. Let's round them up. Mm-hmm. But he wasn't getting tried until April of 45.
The father, yes.
Okay.
And he was arrested in immediately after the assassination attempt, which was in June of 1944, or July of 1944. So in April of 1945, Ewald Heinrich was tried by Judge Friesling, and during that trial, one of the largest, the largest, in fact, air raid ever to hit Berlin came over. The court, the prisoners, the lawyers, the judge were all evacuated to a bomb shelter in the basement. The building was hit, and the judge was killed in the explosion. Everyone else survived, but that's how he ended. However, the participants were still sentenced to death. They were sentenced by other judges, and Ewald Heinrich was sent to the Plötzensee.
Wait a second, I'm getting a little mixed up now. Ewald Senior.
I'm sorry, Ewald, not Ewald Heinrich. Ewald was the father.
Ewald the father. Senior, the father, was, despite having been saved by the bomb briefly, was then sentenced by other judges to death.
Yes.
And then what happened to him?
He went to the Plötzensee prison, and eventually it was in late April of 1944, a month before the...
45,
I'm sorry, was guillotined.
Wow.
The guillotine, not a lot of people know about this, but the Reich guillotined in the neighborhood of 16,000 people. The guillotine was reserved primarily for treason. Disobedience, refusal to obey orders, other things like that, political crimes, hanging, treason, guillotine. And very kind of an oblique side note, one of Germany's, in fact, Germany's preeminent anatomy manual was created during and after the Second World War by doctors who received the bodies of guillotine victims and then dissected them and had, you know, in the same manner you'd do a normal autopsy and dissection. But the primary subjects of those dissections were guillotine victims.
I did not know.
Yeah. So anyway, the father, Heinrich von Kleist, was guillotined by the Germans at the Plötzensee prison. His son was sent to a concentration camp, a political concentration camp.
Ewald Heinrich.
Ewald Heinrich, okay. who just died recently. And for reasons unknown, and the best reason that anyone can come up with is that he was confused for someone else, he was eventually released and returned to duty in the Wehrmacht.
You're kidding me.
No,
he's one of the Hitler conspirators. They have convicted him. They put him in a concentration camp.
Well, he was never convicted. He was not on trial, just his father was.
But, you know, in the Nazi regime, whether you get a trial or not, it's almost immaterial. They had arrested him for plotting against Hitler, and he gets released.
He got off scot-free.
That's remarkable. But, of course, they sent him back to the Russian front in the final months of the war.
Yes, right at the very end of the war, he was returned to duty.
Not a good place to be, but apparently he survived that, too.
Well, the front kept getting closer and closer to home.
So it wasn't that long a trip, then,
no.
I guess, right.
And then after the war, as many of the family members did, he escaped to the West and was able to begin a new life after the war in the West.
So he came and surrendered to the British or the Americans?
I don't know exactly who he surrendered.
But somebody in the West.
Yeah, the Western.
And you're right, a lot of people wanted to do that because, with all due respect to the Russians, at least at that time, their regime was not really that much different than the Nazi regime in terms of its terror and its authoritarianism. And they certainly were not well disposed toward their German prisoners of war.
They had experienced something different in their homeland than we, our soldiers, experienced who were fighting abroad on someone else's soil.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with my former student, my current colleague, and my buddy, Erich von Kleist, all about his not-so-well-known but nonetheless noble relative, several noble relatives who fought against Hitler. After the break, we'll continue our conversation with Erich and hear about what happened after the Second World War, so stay tuned.
After James Madison's death, Montpelier was sold several times, first to Henry Moncure in 1844. In 1848, Moncure sold the property to Benjamin Thornton, an Englishman. In 1854, Thornton sold Montpelier to William H. McFarland, a prominent banker from Richmond and a native Virginian. McFarland's purchase of Montpelier from the Englishman Thornton was enthusiastically supported in the local press. The Charlottesville Jeffersonian and Fredericksburg News noted that, "We are glad that this estate has fallen into the hands of a Virginian, and it is hoped that a suitable monument may now be erected over the remains of Virginia's eminent statesman and patriot." McFarland had given Madison's eulogy in 1836 at a memorial service in Richmond. He only remained at the property for a little more than a year, and his use or impact upon it is unclear. With the Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
To Weekly Constitutional, I'm Stuart Harris. Now let's conclude our conversation with Erich von Kleist, all about his illustrious relations who resisted Hitler, including one named Ewald Heinrich von Kleist, who served as a lieutenant in the Wehrmacht and who tried twice to kill Hitler.
So he surrenders to the Western Allies, and then what did he do?
Well, after the war, he started a publishing company and became active in political efforts in Germany and established the what continues to this day is an annual conference in Berlin on security. It's called the Berlin Security Conference, and was the moderator of that, the chair of that, until late in his life. And that's an annual international security conference that is attended by a lot of countries.
Well, if he did that during the post-war era, then I guess he became a Cold Warrior when West Germany was allied with the United States, right?
Yes, definitely. He was the family had did not have communist leanings, as it didn't have Nazi leanings. Mm-hmm.
But if I understood you correctly, the ancestral family home was then in what was called East Germany, right?
And actually, it what became Poland after the
so definitely behind
of
the Iron Curtain.
Absolutely.
So the von Kleist who escaped west
lost everything
except the name. Mm-hmm.
At the time, early in the family history, there were something like 60 estates, titled estates, and at the time of the war, they were down to about 14, mm-hmm. and after that, there were none. It was all over. The titles, some people kept their titles, but they didn't keep any of the property. And in fact, his Ewald Heinrich's cousin in another house, a branch of the family, as the Russians were approaching, he also was in the Wehrmacht and was an army officer, blew up the mansion just to keep the Russians from getting it.
For heaven's sake. That's yeah. Wow. Have you ever been back to the family?
No, I would like to now that the wall has fallen and it's possible to travel there. I have had the pleasure of meeting Ewald Heinrich's cousin, who also named Heinrich, mm-hmm. But from the House von Kleist von Retzau, who was the head of the family association for many years. And he was a 12-year-old boy in Berlin and was drafted into the defense of Berlin at the end of the war.
Oh, dear.
Given a uniform and a rifle and told to stop the Russians, which didn't succeed.
Yeah, I was going to say it didn't work out so well for him, but he survived.
Apparently. He was captured by the Russians. He was captured by the Americans. They were supposed to turn the Russian prisoners they had over to the German prisoners they had over to the Russians, but the Americans kind of smuggled him out and took him back with them to the West, so he managed to avoid being turned over to the Russians.
Yeah, good for him. You mentioned he was the head of a family association. That was going to be my next line of questioning is, obviously the von Kleists are still around, and obviously
yes.
This is a large family, and so apparently a number of them have survived, and they apparently have an association. Tell me about this.
The family association, it extends back to the feudal era when only you had to be able to prove who you were in order to maintain possession of the land. In many cases in the German system, when a head of a family died, the titled family, the land would revert back to the duke or the primary subject of the king in that area. Mm-hmm. In those cases where you were given the land essentially out of hand, that is, it would say in your family, as long as there was a surviving male heir, mm-hmm. It was very important to keep track of who was who.
Right.
And so the family association has been in existence for hundreds of years in one form or another. The modern family association was started after the Second World War as to keep the family together, basically.
Right, and I guess there are probably members both in the former East and former West Germanies, right?
Yes, there are at this time, if I'm recalling correctly, 19 extant houses or branches of the family, all of which descend from three lines, three sons from going way back to the 1300s, 1200s. And there are family members. A family was found in Russia recently. A line of the family was found not to have gone extinct, but to be still be carried on in Russia. There are family members in Argentina, as odd as that may sound, here in the United States, but primarily in Germany.
Very interesting. So what are the names of these branches, these three basic branches?
They are very long names that, as you said, the Germans put things together.
Uh-huh.
The three lines were the Tikau Duberau, the Mutren Damen, and the Vilnau Raditz. And the Vilnau Raditz line died out in the 18th century, in the 1700s.
I see.
The first von Kleist who came to America was actually a Hessian officer in the Revolutionary War and fought for the British.
He was one of the Hessian troops.
Yes, fought for the British. Went home after the war, didn't stay.
Just a visitor.
Yes, and then my house of the family came over in the late 1800s. Like my great-great-great-grandfather was a ship captain out of the Baltic Sea in Prussia and came here and operated out of the United States, moved to the United States.
So your branch of the von Kleist has been here since the early 19th century.
Late 19th century.
Right. But nonetheless, you're still very much aware of your German lineage and your family association and all of that.
I inherited the name but nothing else, and it reminds me of the story about the man who was talking to a lizard, and the lizard used to say, "Well, my great grandmother was a dinosaur." Again, it's like having vanity tags that never expire.
I understand. Let me ask you this, though. Getting back to Ewald Heinrich, was the family aware of his exploits in World War II immediately after the war, or was there some period of time before that story came out?
No, the family was aware of them at the time. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was the entire family was very anti-Hitler, especially his branch, and his cousins were also very anti-Hitler at the same time, another branch of the family, and they were aware of that. The entire story really kind of only trickled out, after the war, when it was safe for it to get out, because up until that point, while Hitler was still in power, while the Reich was still existing, it would have been, deadly for anybody who had been acknowledged to have been a part of that.
Right.
Or even for family members.
And some years later, at least one book was written about this, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What's the title of the book?
The book actually is called The Matriarch of Conspiracy. Mm-hmm. It's about Ruth von Kleist, who is Ewald Heinrich's aunt, and who married into the von Kleist family years ago, and was the mother of several of the people who participated in these plots and also worked internally against the Nazi regime while it was there. She was very close to Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was the head of the church in Germany, the confessional church that was anti-Hitler, and who was also executed. He was hanged. He wasn't guillotined, but she was very close to him. He was going to marry her granddaughter. They were engaged when he was arrested and then later executed.
So there were lots of Nazi hunters or Nazi opponents in the von Kleist clan. Well, Count, this is just a fascinating history, and now I have to ask you the touchy-feely question. How does this make you feel? Is this a source of family pride for you personally to know that you are descended from a Hitler conspirator?
Yes, yes, absolutely, without qualification. It's not something I can take direct ownership of. I was not alive then. It's not something, and I'm not even directly descended from this branch of the family. But it's nice to know that although members of my family, extended family, were serving in the Wehrmacht, were serving as generals and field marshals in Hitler's army, that the family was not not driven by Nazi ideology. Mm-hmm. They were professional soldiers. That was their history, their lineage, and they resisted to the extent that they could. In fact, the Field Marshal Ewald von Kleist, different Ewald, mm-hmm. Was fired by Hitler in mid-1943 because he refused to obey an order to hold his ground, and he conducted what is arguably the most successful retreat in modern military history.
Really?
Operation Barbarossa in the south, going mm-hmm. through the Turkish oil fields. He brought back most of his army and didn't get captured, whereas if he had stayed there, he would have lost several hundred thousand men as prisoners of war when that would have been overtaken by the Russians.
Fascinating.
So he was fired. Lived in Berlin for the duration of the war as a civilian, and then after the war was arrested, was sent eventually to the Russians to be tried as a war criminal, and was convicted for having, with kindness and affection, alienated the peoples of the Soviet Union.
What? What? He was too nice to the people he was conquering, and therefore the Russians thought he was a war criminal.
Exactly. In the areas he commanded, that were under his command while he was going through conquering them, he refused to allow conscription of labor from the population. He established a volunteer labor force, which, as much as you could be a volunteer under those circumstances, but refused to allow the SS conscription to go on in his areas of influence. And in fact, was successful in recruiting people to perform labor for the German army, and that was the ultimate thing that he was convicted for. He was sentenced to, I think, 10 years in a prison camp, and didn't live through that.
Died of
health conditions while he was in the prison camp.
Yeah, Soviet justice was not exactly an example to the world.
I'm sure the prison camp conditions weren't extremely good.
No, I imagine that wasn't a very pleasant experience. I'm awfully sorry. He's a guy who got punished for doing the right thing, it sounds like.
Well, except for the fact that he was invading their country.
Well, okay. Now, that I will grant you, I understand also the Russians were pretty upset about that, but by and large, under international law, a professional soldier who is in an army is not going to be considered a war criminal, and especially one who treats people under his control in a humane fashion is not going to be considered a war criminal. So it does sound still pretty questionable to me whether he should have been convicted of anything, but nonetheless, okay, I'm sorry he ended up that way. I'm just curious, did the branch of the von Kleists in the United States, did they carry on the military tradition? Have the von Kleists been members of the American military since they've been here?
Not in the same sense that they did in the old world. Mm-hmm. Members of the family have been in, U.S. Army, U.S. Navy, Second World War, Vietnam.
They were in the U.S. Army during the Second World War.
In the U.S. Navy during the Second World
War. In the Navy, okay.
My own grandfather fought in the Pacific against in the Navy, mm-hmm. During the Second World War. So, yeah, you had von Kleist on both sides of the family fighting on opposite sides of the...
But none of them actually coming across the battlefield from each other.
No.
Okay,
no,
not quite that stark a contrast. Well, that is an absolutely fascinating tale, and I very much appreciate you sharing it with us.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity. Next to talking about myself, talking about my family is my favorite thing in the world.
And that's our show. Thanks so much to my buddy, Eric von Kleist. And thanks also to our scheduler, Carol Hutchinson, although I scheduled this one. And thanks also to Nick Rosa and to Bob Hoffman, our distribution engineers. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.